I think, yeah, I have to come to defense of industry. I mean, you pointed out that they're promoting revolution, but at least one division of one corporation, the Buick Corporation, has recognized the crisis in values, and that's why they advertise the Buick as something to believe in. There's an interesting comment in Chesterton's Everlasting Man. He said, a dead dog can be lifted up in the leaping water with all the swiftness of a leaping hound, but only a live dog can swim backwards. And he said, a paper boat can ride the rising deluge with all the airy arrogance of a ferry ship, but if the ferry ship sails upstream, it is really rowed by the ferries. That's a hell of a way to introduce you, isn't it, Frank? I'm not calling Frank a fairy, but conservatism in some ways has been a paper boat going upstream, and Frank has been in there rowing for a number of years. What he really is a moody elf. At least that's what a moody elf, that's what Alan Drury called him recently, or some of those who signed that declaration of suspension of support of Nixon. They're the myth minority. So you can pick and choose, take what you want. Frank Meyer was educated at Princeton and Oxford, and I think he also went to Balliol, didn't you, Frank?
That's the Oxford College.
Oh, that's it. Pursued graduate studies at the University of Chicago. Was a senior editor of National Review and an editorial advisor of Modern Age. His column, Principles and Heresies, is a regular feature in National Review. He's also the author of The Molding of Communists, In Defense of Freedom, and The Conservative Mainstream. He's reported to be working on a new book, The Shape of History. I'm not going to say any more about you, Frank. If I were to read everything, it would take you long.
Will Herberg has shown elaborately and ably the basic strength of conservatism in America today, socially, culturally, intellectually. I am going to the greatest degree to concentrate on what at this moment in history is a somewhat darker side of the picture, the narrowly political side. I want to discuss the state of the conservative movement today, not in terms of the political situation in which we find ourselves in 1971, in no way derogating from not only what Herberg has said about the general mood of the American people, but something I could have added, the great breadth, depth, and general strength of the conservative movement as a movement, that is, those persons who are consciously following conservative attitudes and moved by them today as compared with 10 or 12 years ago. But fundamentally, I guess, essentially discuss the point that was touched upon in the last part of the previous speech, namely the political situation and the impact and future of conservatism in the political situation, and in the narrower sense of the word. To know where we are in any situation, it is necessary to stop for a moment and see clearly how we got where we are, whence we came, what is the particular moment of our course. Therefore, I think it is worth examining at a little length the genesis and history of our movement, and thereby not only where we are, but what we are. The crystallization in the past 15 or 20 years of an American conservative movement, and I agree with Mr. Herberg that a mere 15 years ago, nobody called themselves a conservative in America, and Taft did call himself a liberal. The crystallization in the past 15 or 20 years of a specifically American conservative movement, is it a late reaction to the revolutionary transformation of America that began with the election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932? That revolution itself has been seen in the light of history only a gentler, more humane, bloodless expression in the United States of the revolutionary wave that swept the globe in the 20th century. Its grimmest, most total manifestations have been the phenomena of communism and Nazism. In rather peculiar forms in late years, it has expressed itself in the so-called nationalism typified by Nasser and Nkrumah and Sukarno. In Western Europe, it has taken the forms of the socialism of England or Scandinavia. Everywhere, however, open or masked, it represents an aggrandizement of the power of the state over the lives of individual persons. Always that aggrandizement is cloaked in a rhetoric and a program putatively directed to and putatively concerned for the masses. The American form of that revolution differs little in its essentials, its inner essentials, from Western European democratic socialism. But by an ironic twist of history, it has become known as liberalism. Far removed as it is from the classical liberalism of the 19th century, with its overriding concern for individual liberty and for the limitation of the state. Ushered in by the election of 1932, so thorough was the victory of liberalism that for many years afterwards, it met with no concerted resistance either in the intellectual or political spheres. It's true, islands of resistance remained, and people fought hard from those islands, in the Congress, in the academy among some economists and humanists, in the business community, in the endemic mass anti-communist feeling among some strata of the population. But these were, for some years, decades, only rearguard actions. By and large, liberalism dominated the scene, took over the academy and the organs of mass communication, controlled the Democratic Party, and slowly penetrated the Republican Party. Only in the past decade or two has there emerged a consistent, cohesive conservative movement based upon a broad consensus of principle, challenging liberal assumptions and liberal power all along the line. In its origins, intellectual, centered among a group of writers gathered around the Old Freeman, National Review, Modern Age, it early attracted a following and guided a movement in the universities. One can speak of stages in its development of the foundation of ISI and of YAF, and gradually focused and channelized the energies of disparate tendencies opposed to liberalism through all levels of society. Later, its attitude began to be reflected in the political world, first among a group of young congressmen. And it fully emerged on the national political arena with the nomination of Barry Goldwater at the Republican Convention of 1964. Before, however, discussing in detail that emergence, and the more recent developments in the specifically political realm, I should like briefly to describe the consensus of principle that is the consensus of contemporary American liberalism. Because I must say I disagree with Professor Paolucci that which American conservatism stands for is the liberal tradition. It is not, in my opinion, as I hope to show very briefly here, either a liberal tradition in the 19th century sense or a conservative tradition in the 19th century sense. In fact, one can claim for it the oldest heritage of any existing political sentiment of strength in the world. It goes back to the 18th century. It was established by our constitutional fathers. The American tradition is not liberal or conservative. It is pre-liberal and pre-conservative. It predates the French Revolution. This consensus, which I want to outline, is reflected with different degrees of understanding and depth at every level of the conservative movement. With greater clarity and greater detail among intellectuals, with more instinctively and in a broader sense in the broad base. It underlies the principled positions of the consciously intellectual as it does the empirical positions of political activists. The clearest way, I think, to summarize this consensus is to contrast it with the beliefs and attitudes of the liberal world outlook, which sets the prevailing tone of conservatism. A tactic, despite the existence of many conservative Democrats and of occasional possibility of supporting Democrats. But the clear tactic throughout of the conservative movement politically has been to gain control of the Republican Party as the vehicle for achieving national power. In the years from 1961 through 1964, with incredible rapidity, considering the youth of the movement, that first tactical task was largely achieved. In the course of the struggle to control the Republican Party, the conservative movement grew, strengthened its personnel, gained experience. By 1964, and this must be realized for a movement that the earliest came into existence in 1950 and didn't become politically significant until 1960 or 61, in those few years, we had reached the point that by 1964, the Republican Party was won for conservative leadership. Half the battle was won. The vehicle to achieve national control was in the hands of the conservative movement. With the defeat of November 1964, however, and heaven knows that no one who does not realize that in a war, defeats are going to take place, that battle after battle will take place. The defeat of 1964 sent the conservative movement into headlong retreat. Instead of consolidating the positions won in the years up to 64, instead of moving forward toward further control expansion of that political situation, the leadership of the Republican Party, being still in their hands with a good fight, instead of preparing for the future, the conservative movement suffered nothing less than a colossal failure of nerve. This, I think, is the key fact of the history of the past two decades. Having within our hands a vehicle which could have been moved from presidential year to presidential year, constantly gaining in strength, the conservative movement let its nerveless hands fall from the wheel. Instead of starting in 1965 to consolidate and expand the ground won and working for the next 4 years to repeat the challenge of 1964 with better preparation, better tactics, better management, better leadership. Conservative leaders in large and decisive numbers moved into the camp of the prize opportunist of the 20th century, Richard Nixon, placing the hope of an easy Republican win over conservative principle, despite the failure to drive forward after 1964. Conservatives still were in a distinct majority at the Republican Convention of 1968. As conservatives, as people in general moved by the conservative consensus, the majority of that convention were conservatives. But two-thirds of those conservative delegates voted for Richard Nixon against the clear conservative position of Ronald Reagan at that time. Conservatives could have with ease nominated a conservative candidate had the drive for one begun in 1965. But they were divided, and they got Richard Nixon. In the course of this maneuver, incidentally, they handed over millions of conservative voters, good, solid people, people who could not stomach Nixon, to the populism, the ignorantism, and the demagogy of George Corley Wallace. To the degree that Wallace in any way leads people of basic conservative principle down the primrose path to populism, it is the responsibility of the conservative leaders who led to the nomination of Richard Nixon in 1964. The net result of this politics of pragmatism and opportunism has been the disarming of the conservative movement as a current political force on a national scale. I'm not saying it has been disarmed on a local basis. I am specifically not saying it's weaker than it was in 61 or 64. It's stronger. But insofar as the strength and momentum of this is attached by gears to the political wheel on a national level, I repeat what I have said. This conservative movement has been disarmed. It doesn't mean to say we can't elect a Jim Buckley in New York and can't do that same kind of thing elsewhere. It does mean that as far as 1972 is concerned, to a very large degree, the energies of the conservative movement were in empty air. Until the 11th hour, our movement has been bound in the public eye to an administration of disarmament relative to the rapid superarmament of the Soviet Union and of intense danger to the survival of the United States. An administration of retreat before communism in China. An administration of massive proposed welfare increases. Of record expenditures and deficits and record inflation. Of across-the-board government control of the economy. All that differentiates it from this administration, from a Humphrey administration, is a couple of Supreme Court appointments, a slower retreat in Vietnam than Humphrey might have carried out, and a great deal of rhetoric about law and order. Something, but not enough to save the soul and the public credit of a conservative movement, which in principle stands for the consensus I laid forward, and in practice before the public has been attached to support of the Nixon administration. The result of the failure of nerve of 1965 to 1968, and of the past 3 years' proof of a pudding we concocted, is that at this time the conservative movement has no serious national presidential political impact. The recent statement suspending support was a definite step in the necessary actions to extricate the conservative movement from this situation. But I believe it must be said that it certainly came much too late to seriously affect 1972. The only way it can seriously affect it is if it and things which follow it up force Nixon to changing his course under that conservative pressure. So far, there are no signs of it. And it would have to be quite a sharp change of course considering the Rubicons he has crossed in the past few months. It is a correct move, in my opinion, because I think conservatives have to begin to put pressure to show their position. But in my opinion, and I imagine many of those who signed the same statement that I did were not thinking of it in these terms, in my opinion, however, the most important aspect of it is not the possibility of affecting Nixon or of 1972, because I don't think it can be done, but saving the soul and the future of the conservative movement. Although we are, as a movement, larger, stronger, have a greatly enlarged and skilled personnel than we had in 1961, although we are, as a part of American life, deeper, broader, winning people in the sense that Will Herberg mentioned, broadening and strengthening out in the social, the cultural, the intellectual, the lower political spheres, the lower levels of it. We are, for practical political purposes on the presidential arena, about back where we were in 1961. I think it's necessary to realize where we stand. I want to stress we're much stronger than in 61, but in the sense of having the cogs that are fit into the gears that will turn the wheels of presidential national politics, we are to some degree with about as much influence as we had in 1961. The job is to rebuild our power, to reach the decisive influence of 1964 again. A much easier job this time. The movement is broader. The country is seeing more of the results of liberalism and its radical spawn. The country is ready in the sense that Will Herberg indicated for this sort of. And the circumstances of an incumbent, however, today, the circumstances of an incumbent president whom we put there and who cannot be seriously challenged in his own party makes anything like 64 impossible at San Diego, not even to be thought of. There is no possibility of in any way affecting the fate of the nation at San Diego. The threat of non-support in the election, which is a serious one, may swing Nixon back a little more to the right. But that's the best that can be achieved this time around. There is much that can be done in preparation for the future. And it isn't just a matter of assembling our strength and waiting 5 years. It's a matter of what can be done practically in the interval, which is the same thing as preparing for 5 years from now. To work at lower political levels, to find and pick and support local candidates, congressional candidates, senatorial candidates, to reassert the conservative presence throughout the Republican Party in the sense it was being asserted in 63 and 64. To move on issues at every point in campaigns of the various types the conservative movement has put forward. These are the practical possibilities of the next few years. Not to neglect the enormous responsibilities of conservatives outside political action as such, in education, in culture, in the media. My analysis may sound grim, but I want to stress it is not defeatist. There is much to be done, and the future is as hopeful as ever. But if we do not recognize the results of serious error in the past and the true situation of the present, we would disarm ourselves. A battle can only be fought victoriously if the reality of the circumstances is faced unflinchingly and lessons are learned from past errors. The principles of conservatism remain the only hope of the American future. No question. The task may be more difficult than it looked fleetingly a few years ago. But it is a task that can be accomplished if we go about it without false hopes, with understanding, and with determination.